Reinhardt Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me. And it is all about food. I cannot say that enough and remind all of us about everything that we connect with and how food is such an essential part of that. And it's so important not to take it for granted. So, what is it that's all about food? Well, aside from breathing, what can't we live without? Food, water, food. We need it for our energy and sustenance, and it's something that we really can't go without for a long time. Unless, of course, and I'm not going to go into fasting today and water fasting, but people with a certain amount of girth on them can go for a while with just water and no food. But food is connected to, gosh, so many things, and especially during this time period where we've got a bunch of holidays and things to celebrate and be grateful for, I think it's important to really think about, before you put that nourishment into your mouth, think about where that food came from and really go back to where it really came from. It's really quite convoluted when you think about our food today. There's all this vertical integration and so many different businesses and companies involved, and yet we tend to, especially when we're hungry and on the road and eating fast food or whatever, just grab the food and bite it and guzzle it down and never even think twice about it. But it's really fascinating to think about, if we're going to talk about plant food, because that's what I like to talk about, plant food, but just starting with the seed and acquiring the seed is a project too. And I like, as a personal project, to save some of the seeds for my own food, because I think that's part of something that's in our nature, to save seeds, because it is an investment in our future. So we start with a seed and grow that seed in the soil, and there's many people today that are involved with growing food in this country. There are the small farmers, there are the larger farmers, and then there are many migrant workers that come up through all kinds of challenging situations just to be involved in the planting and the harvesting of our food, and all of the political ramifications that are involved with their personal lives and the benefits and the mistreatment that occurs to them. Also, if the food is planted with pesticides and herbicides, those people that are involved in planting those foods are exposed to those toxins. And that's just the planting of the food. And then there's the growing and the nurturing and the fertilizing. And where does the fertilizer come from? Most often in conventional farming, fertilizer comes from the petrochemical industry. And so as we see the cost of our food going up, lots of it comes from all the connection that we have with oil, not just the transportation and the fuel costs, but the fertilizer costs. And to get the fertilizer to the soil is a whole industry in itself. So every step of the way is an industry or many industries that are involved. And so let's go further. The food is harvested, and there are many people that are required to harvest the food. Oh, but I wanted to say that the people that are involved in the growing of the food, when pesticides and herbicides are used, those people are exposed to a lot of toxins. And one of the reasons why I encourage eating organic and why I like to eat organic is just because it's good for me and the people that I'm feeding, the people that I care about, but the people that are growing the food, the ones that are exposed directly to those toxic chemicals, it's very damaging, and I don't want to participate in that. I don't support that. I don't want to benefit from someone else's exploitation. We are all connected. And then the food is harvested, and it can go into a variety of different avenues. And it's just a very long, long, interesting process. And I encourage you, before you take that bite, to just think a little bit about where your food came from. And we're not even talking about industrial farming of animals. That's a whole other story, and it's horrifying. But I'll save that for another day. So it's spring, and things are growing, and people are starting their gardens, and it's a beautiful thing. But what I want to talk about today, with a very, very special guest that I'm very excited to bring on, we're going to be talking about sprouting. Gardens of mini vegetables were part of Sproutman's lifetime fight against chronic allergies and asthma. After 20 years of disappointment with orthodox medicine, he became symptom-free through his use of diet, juices, and fasting. In 1980, he founded the Sprout House, a no-cooking school in New York City, teaching the benefits of a living foods diet. Steve is a health crusader and author of 10 books, including Power Juices, Super Drinks, Wheatgrass, Nature's Finest Medicine, Juice Fasting and Detoxification, and Food Combining and Digestion. His most recent book is The Organic Food Guide, How to Shop Smarter and Eat Healthier. He has been featured on PBS, the Home Shopping Network, TV Food Network, and in Better Nutrition Prevention, Organic Gardening, and Flower and Garden magazines. His sprouting inventions, such as the hemp sprout bag, are sold nationwide. And he has a website, sproutman.com. Please welcome Steve Meyerowitz, the Sproutman. Hi, Steve. How do you pronounce your last name? I didn't quite get that right.
Just like you said it, Meyerowitz.
Meyerowitz, well, yeah.
There's an extra syllable in there, but, you know, I have to give that one to my ancestors.
You're right. Yeah, I've been always wanting to miss that one extra syllable, but I want to give every one of your syllables its worth.
Well, you're better than me. I usually skip it myself.
Anyway, Sproutman. I like Sproutman better. You are a superhero in my book. You're definitely a superhero.
Yay.
Well, I've known about you for a long time, and so it's very exciting for me to be able to speak with you one-on-one.
Yeah.
And you have some wonderful books, and you really have been ahead of your time, or ahead of our time, because the information that are in some of your books that have been reprinted and reissued is information that's still new to many people and have kind of been repackaged by many, many others.
Well, you know, a lot of what you were talking about is still valid today, and it was the impetus for me to move in the direction of organic food and growing my own food. It's because of those quality issues. And, you know, as we learned with the smoking industry, it took us decades to change our habits and to change that industry, which still today markets to our teenagers.
Yeah.
So, you know, changing the whole petroleum connection with agriculture and changing our diet to a more plant-based, healthier diet, getting the pesticides and preservatives and artificial flavors and colors out of our food system, because they don't belong there.
Amen.
They're not good for human bodies. You know, they're all that packaging and all of the canning and microwaving and frying that we do in our culture is so unhealthy. And unfortunately, you know, there is a segment of our society that is just immovable on issues like this, and we're just going to have to be patient until the supermarket shelves start to change. And they have. We have seen changes. You can go into all the big supermarket chains in the United States and find organic food sections now. And that wasn't the case back in the 70s when I started out.
Right.
I had to go to health food stores, and the pickings were slim, and
mm-hmm.
the price was expensive.
Mm-hmm. It's so bizarre how one of the things that I don't understand is how we call food that's grown with pesticides and herbicides conventional food or conventional farming, and yet it's not conventional. It's sci-fi farming. That's not how we grew food for millions of years.
That's right, and there's so much politics and lobbyists behind this, so much money, because why shouldn't we be allowed to identify the genetically modified products on the label?
Mm-hmm.
We put every little calorie, on the labels because the Food and Drug Administration feels it's important for people to know. But it's also important for us to know if it's been farmed with genetically modified plants. So, but that's not happening yet because the lobbyists are too powerful and too wealthy. So it's everyone is out there for themselves. We all have to educate ourselves, and we all have to look at labels. And when we walk down those market aisles, we have to make intelligent decisions, not fast decisions, but considered decisions to get the best quality food, and therefore have longevity and good health.
Well, I really believe that if we put this information out there enough, in these venues like we're doing right now and wherever we can in books and articles and just talking to our friends and family, the more we put it out there, the more people are going to move in this direction. And we're seeing it. It's just slow, and it's certainly not fast enough for me.
Well, that's why I'm grateful to you, Karen, for putting on this program every week and helping spread the good word. We need it.
Yes. Say hallelujah.
Yeah.
And I want to thank the listeners, too. I get feedback from time to time. I really appreciate it. You can send me emails at info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org, for comments anytime during the week. Or if you have a question today during the show, today happens to be April 20th, 2011, if you're listening to us live, or if you're listening to us in the future, hello out there in the future, you can still communicate with us via email messages. The whole downloading of podcast thing is fascinating to me, the way people can listen to it. And we're now on iTunes, too, so go to the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website if you're into listening that way. It's just amazing. Okay, so we're doing what we can. We're doing the best we can. And for those that want to hear this information, here it is. And so you had your own story. You weren't feeling well, and you had allergies and asthma and all kinds of stuff, and you ended up developing a way to feel better. And now you're promoting all this information, and you have been for decades, which is great, and you sell products and write books. But your specialty, I'm assuming, are sprouts.
Well, it's my claim to fame. It's sort of like an actor that is typecast. So even though I have books on a wide range of health and diet topics, my nom de plume is Sprout Man, and it's my trademark name, and it is it's catchy, and that's what people think of me by. And through all these years, I started teaching sprouting in 1977, I don't mind it. And the reason why I don't mind it is because what I'm teaching, and when I talk about sprouts is a very simplistic five-letter word, but really what I'm talking about is bringing in high-quality living foods into the diet on a daily basis, Food that you can grow on your own in your kitchen without soil and without a green thumb is the ultimate in local agriculture. And I really believe that, that with the population doubling by 2055, the population is supposed to be 15 billion.
It's too crowded already.
It is.
Stop making babies.
Yeah, right. Between 1950 and 2000, in that 50-year range, we a little more than doubled. We're almost 7 billion on the planet right now. The problem is that because of we have to feed all these people and because we have to house them, we have less and less arable land
mm-hmm.
for agriculture. So, we're building condos and shopping malls on former farmland. And so, food is coming from further and further away, as you related earlier, where part of the cost of food is the cost of petroleum. So basically the International Food Distribution Network is going to control what we eat, the variety of what we eat, and the price
or the lack of variety of what we eat.
Exactly. So what I'm proposing is let's become a little more food independent. Let's become a little bit self-sufficient. You don't have to have a green thumb, like I said. Gardening without soil, gardening these seedlings, which essentially grow in 1 week's time, is a very easy thing to do, and yet the nutrient density of these vegetables at this early stage of life is 50 to 100 times higher than the nutrition that's in the same vegetable when it's mature, even if it's organically grown. It's, we're talking about a seedling of radish that's 5 days old versus a 65-day-old radish plant.
Now, that's really incredible because it's just a little tiny seed, and all we do is put it in water. Where is all that nutrition coming from?
Well, it's the miracle of germination, Karen. It is this thing where you have the everything necessary for the growth of a mature vegetable is embedded inside that seed. And once we moisten it, it starts this activity, this voracious activity. It's literally a protein factory racing to grow a mature vegetable. And when we actually get it at the first leaf division, that's the seedling stage. At that point, the nutrient density is greater than at any future point in the plant's life. And that's why we can have things like vitamin A in radishes in the mature vegetable in the garden is 8 international units. But in the 5-day-old seedling, it's 391.
Wow.
About 40 times more.
And it's not toxic like you get in a pill.
It's non-toxic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, this is one of the reasons why we take supplements, right? It's because we take herbal supplements because we want the concentration of the medicinal properties in that herb, whether it's echinacea for a cold or ginseng or St. John's wort for mood and temperament. Plant compounds, not just the ABCD vitamins, but these plant compounds that the antioxidants and the bioflavonoids and the trace minerals and the carotenes, the phytosterols, all of these plant compounds are actually medicinal in nature, and that's why we take herbal medicine to get those phytochemicals, and that's why we take supplements, because we want a concentration of the nutrients, and that's why we take juices, because when you juice a pound of carrots, you can drink the result, which is a glass of carrot juice. No way you could physically consume a pound of carrots, but you can drink easily and digest easily the result of the juice from a pound of carrots. So it's a nutrient concentrate, and that's what we have in these baby plants. It's that nutrient concentration that makes them so not only so nutritious but also medicinal in their properties.
I remember somebody saying that it's not natural to eat sprouts because in nature we wouldn't naturally eat sprouts. Now, I don't know if that matters or not, but what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, there's always another perspective on every topic.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of people out there who are opposed to drinking too much water. You know, I'm really big on drinking a lot of water. I have a book called Water, the Ultimate Cure, where approximately 67% water in terms of our weight. And water is absolutely necessary for cushioning our bones and for delivering nutrients to our tissues. And yet there are people out there who will say that it's a fallacy to drink the old standard 8 glasses of water a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's always somebody who has got something to say contrary. There's eating these seedlings is, you know, we have abundant seedlings, and we're eating them for our health and wellness. And there's a lot of things we do for our health and wellness that could be criticized, you know, such as eating animals. You know, why not let them live? Plants are much lower on the scale of consciousness, although I agree plants are conscious. You can actually see the effect on plants with different kinds of music. You know, they'll respond to acid rock.
Yeah.
And they'll respond to Mozart.
Right.
So and we have studies on this. So they have a consciousness, but they are happily serving us to further our health and nutrition, because let's face it, we're higher up on the evolutionary scale.
Well, you know, sometimes I think that the plants are the ones that are guiding us and making us do what we do in order to keep them going. But I don't want to go down that path today. That's another discussion. So sprouts. Now sprouts, you know, we have improved in the last couple of decades getting more organic food in the supermarkets and non-dairy milks, and soy foods are getting popular placement in supermarkets more than before, and all of that's really good. And we even see boxes of sprouts in some stores, especially the mung bean sprouts, because of the growing Asian communities that consume a lot of that type of sprout. But sprouts, their image hasn't really changed much in the last few decades. It's still in that hippy-dippy, groovy kind of space. Why is that, Sprout Man?
You know, the industry, the sprouting industry, is not a wealthy one, and it hasn't had a PR program.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I'm involved in helping the industry start a PR program, and June is going to be the National Sprout Month.
Ah, I don't like that.
So we're going to start to add some emphasis, because these are essentially baby vegetables. You know, there's a couple of ways to think about sprouts. You have the bean sprouts, like you mentioned, from the Asian world, countries. You have mung beans and soybeans are really big, and we can sprout lentils, which are really easy. So, and green peas and, sometimes chickpeas, although they're a little finicky, sprouters. So there's those bean sprouts, which are essentially beans with a tail. But what I really have been promoting all these years are the microgreens, are the baby vegetables that are anywhere from 3 to 12 inches tall and are bushy and have big green leaves. And I'll name some. Sunflower, which is in the microgreen family because it's anywhere from 8 to 12 inches tall, and it has a leaf spread from left to right of approximately an inch.
And they're delicious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have pea shoots, which are also, you know, 10 to 12 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
Buckwheat greens, which again, about a 1-inch leaf spread, and the same height. And you know, I suppose wheatgrass can fall into this category, but it's not a salad green. So, and then we also grow many things that we're familiar with in the backyard garden, such as broccoli and radish, and cabbage and kale and alfalfa and clover. Those are not actually common in the backyard. Alfalfa and clover are the kinds of things, you know, farmers grow to feed their cattle and also to enrich the nitrogen content of the soil. So, you know, if it's good for the soil, it's got to be good for people. The problem is that the alfalfa that the farmers grow in the fields is a little bit too fibrous for people to enjoy, although the animals are quite happy because they have different digestion. They have multiple stomachs and multiple pockets in their stomachs and their digestive tract, and so they can handle that excess fiber, horses and cows. But if we grow them to the seedling stage, that alfalfa and that clover and buckwheat is also a cover crop, those leaves are very delicate, very succulent. They have neutral flavors to them, sort of like a Boston lettuce or a bib lettuce taste. And so they're fabulous. And, you know, let's think again of what we're doing here. We're bringing the feeling of springtime into our salads and onto our dinner plates, even if it's in the middle of the winter, even if you live in the Northeast like I do. You're able to have these fresh garden greens in the middle of December, January, February, when the northern climates are digging out of snow. So, you know, what could be more local about agriculture than growing it in your own kitchen?
Well, I'm so happy to be talking to you today because I feel like sprouting is one of the last things that are missing in my life. And I'm going to make a personal commitment to myself after this show to really go for it. I have sprouted for many years. It's kind of an on and off thing. I haven't been consistent about it, and I've tried a variety of things, and I'm going to ask you in a little bit about some of the things I've had trouble sprouting. But I've always enjoyed having it, and I really have to get more committed to it. But this idea of the microgreens I really like because I'm a big salad person. I'm always pushing the greens. I know how important they are. And it's a little inconvenient to have to go out and get them all the time because I eat a lot of them. I'm always running out to get more greens. And they're expensive.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that and about how to do it, because it doesn't have to be complicated. I've kind of devoted my career to spreading the word and getting people set up so that they can do this and making it easy, making it doable, making it practical to fit into what it has become very busy lives for most Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, households now have two working adults in them, and everybody's busy. So, I've got a couple of approaches that keep this thing down to just a couple of minutes a day, and keep it really simple. Again, as I said earlier, you don't need to be a gardener to do this. You don't have to have a green thumb. It's just a simple routine, just like brushing your teeth. It's something that you'll do every day. And really, all we have to give these seedlings is water.
It's not like flossing, is it? Because I brush my teeth, but I don't like flossing.
So that's the backyard garden.
Okay.
Much more complicated. You know, here's some of the basics. We just have to wet them, and we have to rinse them twice a day, and that could be at breakfast time and dinner time. And as long as it's within that or somewhere in that range, you're fine. And you know, the amount of light that we have in the average kitchen is just fine, because these baby leaves are so tiny, they don't really require a lot of light to green up. So, you know, very few of us actually need to have special grow lights to grow these things. Only the apartment dwellers in big cities who have basement apartments with no windows, those are the only types. If you've got windows in your kitchen, that's all you're going to need. It doesn't need direct sunlight. Indirect light is all that's required, and you're probably going to want to have it in your kitchen because you need a water source nearby. So even though you don't have to grow them next to the sink, it's usually it's the most common place where you locate your sprouting equipment, your growing equipment.
Okay.
And I've got two different kinds of sprouters that I'd like to tell you and your audience about, because they're both easy to do. You know, one of them is my sprout bag, which is an invention of mine that started in 1979, and I developed the sprout bag because jars were turning out to be problematic. And you mentioned before you had some missteps in your sprouting career earlier, and this happens to a lot of folks, and it happens because of jars in many cases. And the thing about this is there's a myth that you can sprout with a jar. And I'm not quite sure how that myth started, but you know, the only thing good about jars is that they're commonly available in the kitchen. However, what's bad about them is they don't provide enough airspace for the sprouts to breathe, and they don't provide very good drainage. And people overfill them. They don't really have big enough jars, and so the sprouts get very compressed in there. And when they get compacted like that, they don't breathe very well, and moisture it gets stuck in there. So what happens when you have water retention and lack of good air circulation is that those are the perfect conditions for the development of mold.
Yes.
And people get mold and they say, well, I'm not quite sure where I went wrong here, but I'm jumping off ship because I don't want to eat anything with mold on it. So, you know, and honestly, the kind of mold that grows on sprouts is very similar to the mold that grows on cheese and the mold that grows on bread, which is not going to kill us. It's just it's not pathogenic. It is unsightly and unappetizing, and I'm not recommending that anyone eat it, but it's not going to make you sick in any major way. So, having said that, the way to avoid the mold is to use a sprouter that is designed, you know, for this purpose, for growing. And a jar isn't that. No one ever designed jars to be gardening tools. So my sprout bag, you know, it's like a tea bag. You know, you put the beans inside, you put the seeds inside, and you just dip it. And you dip it at breakfast, and you dip it at dinner, And I'm literally talking about half a minute each time. The whole thing should take a minute of dipping a day. And you can hang the sprout bag on a knob or a cup hook over the sink. You know, it'll take about 10 minutes for it to stop dripping. And you can keep it hanging the rest of the day. And if you don't want to keep it hanging, you don't have to do that either. You can set it in a bowl alongside the sink, or you can set it in the dish rack.
Hmm.
You know, as long as it stops dripping, you know, it just needs a little home. Or like I said, just keep it hanging. And then in the evening, once again, another dip. So if you can use a tea bag, you can use a sprout bag. And the sprouts will breathe on all sides, and they will expand. They're not going to be compressed and limited by a jar. The bag is fabric. Actually, I use hemp fabric. It's very eco-friendly. You know, when the sprouts expand, the bag expands. And so there's no contraction there. And the only thing about the sprout bag is, it's not a very light friendly environment, and neither is a jar, by the way. Even though you have glass on the perimeter of the jar, the sprouts on the inside are all yellow. They don't get light because it's blocked by the other sprouts.
Right.
So you know, and whether you grow them in jars or in sprout bags, those sprouts are all jumbled. So when you want to grow microgreens, you want them to grow straight. You want them to stand up tall.
Strong little shoulders.
Just like vegetables do in the backyard. They grow straight up.
Mm-hmm.
They reach out for the sunshine. And that's really what we want these mini vegetables to be doing as well. So now we're talking about a tray type of sprouter, where the sprouts actually kind of, their roots lock in to some holes in the bottom of the tray, and then the shoots grow straight up. So I have two different types of barrel sprouters, and these barrels, it's called the Fresh Life Sprouter, and you can see a million pictures of these if you go to my website, sproutman.com. And the barrel sprouter, the Fresh Life Sprouter, it's like a little greenhouse. There's a cover on it, but there's about 8 to 10 inches of growing space in there. And one of the versions of these Fresh Life Sprouters is one where we water it ourselves, and another version is where there's actually a little fish tank motor and a water reservoir, and it pulls up the water from the reservoir and sprinkles it on the sprouts for you, for all those people who are too busy and at work all day and don't want to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought. I thought that would be the best idea, because so many people were telling me, you know, I'm going to forget. I'm not going to remember to do this. I'm too busy. So here's a sprouting appliance that actually waters for you.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
But that's for the microgreens, because they can stand tall and you've got that 8-inch growing space. So, you know, you can use a sprout bag to grow some greens. It can be done if you can take a look at the pictures on my website of all of the greens that I can grow in the sprout bag. But it's basically not designed for the straight and tall sprouts. It's basically a jumbled kind of bean sprouter, which you can grow alfalfa in and clover in and radish. So you can get some greens in there. But for the really tall microgreens, for the 10 and 12 inches, you know, you want a vertical tray type system like my Fresh Life Sprouter.
Well, this is very exciting, and I am definitely going to look into this right after the show. But right now, we just need to take a quick break. So, Sproutman, will you stay with us? Because I've got some questions to ask you when we get back.
I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll be back. Hartglass, and you're listening to It's all about food. And I am talking with Sproutman, Steve Meyerowitz. Steve, Sproutman, Mr.
Yeah.
Meyerowitz. I've had some success with some sprouts. Like you said, lentils are really easy, and they certainly are. The bigger ones I found some reasonable luck with. And what I usually do is I have a good-sized jar and rinse them, soak them in the jar, pour off the water, put some cheesecloth on top with a rubber band, and then turn it on an angle into a jar. And the sprouts tend to grow upward into the jar and drain so that they don't get too moldy. And that works pretty well for, like I said, lentils and some bigger beans. And it also works for alfalfa. The two that I have had disasters with are sunflower sprouts, which I love, and I have not been able to make them work, and broccoli sprouts. And I was surprised at the broccoli because they're so much like the smaller sprouts, alfalfa.
Yeah, like alfalfa.
And yet I can't get them going. And they're one of the ones that have really gotten a lot of press in terms of nutrient density and all kinds of anti-cancer fighting properties. And I would really like to up my success rate with
yeah.
broccoli sprouts.
Well, you know, here's where the limitations of jar sprouting start to become more realized, is that, you know, jars are basically an unfavorable or an unfriendly environment for gardening. And you may not see that with seeds like lentils and mung, because they're so carefree, they'll grow no matter what. But when you start getting fussy seeds like broccoli that have lower germination percentages and need a much cleaner environment in terms of drainage and in terms of air circulation, that's when the jars become the limiting factor for successful growing. So, first of all, we want to get the best seed we can, because sprouting is seed-intensive gardening. It's just it's not unlike the garden seeds that we buy for the backyard garden. It's actually a little higher up the evolutionary scale in terms of seeds, because sprouting seeds require higher germination percentages than regular garden seeds. So if you think of 100 seeds and you have 80 of them, let's talk about broccoli again.
Mm-hmm.
If you have 80 broccoli seeds that are sprouting and 20 broccoli seeds that don't sprout, well, when you put those 100 seeds in the garden, you really don't care about those 20, because they'll rot and mold in the soil and you'll
mm-hmm.
never notice it. But when you're in the kitchen garden without soil, and there are 20 seeds out of 100, then that will create rot and mold, and that'll make that'll create headaches for your gardening. So you want a 90% germination minimum for broccoli, and that you're only going to get when you buy your seeds that are selected for sprouting. And there are several brands out there. You don't have to buy my brand. I'm not the only one. I have competitors. But the important thing is that you buy a brand that is that proclaims itself to be sprouting seed. And it will, like garden seed, it will list a germination percentage on it. It will list an expiration date.
Mm.
It'll identify the lot, the farm lot that it came from, just like garden seed. So, you know, one of the problems that people make, one of the mistakes people make, is they go to the health food store and the bulk bins and they buy seed there, and that seed is usually just not sprouting great. So You know, if you think about it, when you're going to plant a backyard garden, you don't go to the grocery store to buy that seed. You go to the garden store, and you have to go to the sprouting section when you want to buy sprouting seed.
Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure how they make the seed differently, but I'm sure
it's a cleaning and selection process, actually. So, you know, when you have 100 seeds and only 80 of them sprout, we go through a cleaning process to remove as many of those 20 that don't sprout.
Right. Interesting.
And so we now have a smaller, more exclusive group of seeds, and it costs a little bit more, but you'll have much more success. So as long as you buy your seed from a package that says a sprouting seed on it, that's great. And if you can't find a line of sprouting seeds in your local health food store, then shop online. You know, whether you go to sproutman.com or one of the, if you just Google, you know, sprouting seeds, you'll find a list of specialty houses that specialize in this kind of thing. And those are the best sources to get the best results in your kitchen.
And is the broccoli sprout, does it work better in the barrel form that you were talking about or in the tray?
Well, it works in both places, but it is easier to grow it in the barrel form. It is easier to grow it vertically because if you think about it, they're little green vegetables, and they do have leaves on them, green leaves, and so they want to grow straight up. But
mm-hmm.
This is one of those seeds where you have a choice. You can grow it in either place quite successfully, but sunflower, unfortunately, sadly for you, Karen, you have to grow that vertically because they have lots of shells on them,
yeah.
The black shells of the sunflower seed, and that, you know, if you grow them in a jumbled grower like the sprout bag or a jar, they'll get all entwined with itself, and it'll be quite a labor to remove the shells, where if you grow them vertically, they just fall off naturally and drop to the bottom.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I'm going to do it.
And you have to get quality seed there because sunflower seed is actually kind of perishable, and so that's where the expiration date comes in handy. It's interesting. The sprout will last for weeks. I've had sunflower sprouts in my refrigerator for almost a month.
Mm.
And you can't possibly do that with common lettuce,
right.
or any produce. But you can do it with these because these are living plants. They still are breathing even in the refrigerator, and I take them out every few days and rinse them and clean them and freshen them up. But they're actually living in your refrigerator. They're not dying in your refrigerator, which is the situation we have when we buy lettuce. That lettuce is dying. The moment the farmer harvested it.
How do you store them in the refrigerator?
Well, I store them in those green bags that are quite popular now, or in some kind of container that has airspace. The important thing is you don't want to suffocate them in a plastic bag because these are breathing plants.
Hmm.
But I was about to say, so even though the plant itself has this great longevity in the refrigerator, the seed is quite perishable. It's the opposite. The seed is, because it has a lot of moisture in it, it's very sensitive, and you only get about 6 months storage. You want to store it in a cool, dry place. So take it out of the plastic bag when you get it in the package in the health food store. Put it in a glass jar. That's really what glass jars are good for, storage, with a sealed lid, a moisture-proof lid, and put it in a cool place, even the refrigerator, and then that will give you the maximum longevity on sunflower seeds. And you can do that with all the sprouting seeds, although some have much better longevity than others.
Now, there have been some discussions of sprouts being dangerous.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure you've heard about some of them. Like buckwheat, for example. You talk about growing buckwheat and making them nice and tall and leafy. And I've read that they can create a toxin in them when they get a little older.
Well, you know, this is a photosensitivity that only happens when you exceed the maximum dosage, which is really not possible to do by eating them. You actually have to juice them or blend them and have them in volume on a daily basis. And even then, you have to have a kind of skin sensitivity to them. So even though, you know, this is a real, this really does exist, in practical terms, it almost never happens.
Okay.
So
that's good.
You know, it's sort of like, you know, it's a little bit like an allergy. You know, not everyone is going to react on their skin to the sun, to the buckwheat sprouts. So you have to be exposed to sunshine, and you have to be overdosing the stuff. And the only way you're going to overdose it is, again, through the juicer or the blender. You can't eat enough buckwheat sprouts to achieve that dosage. So it's a little bit like, you know, we were talking before, earlier about water. You know, you could drown yourself
That's
by drinking too much water. But it's not not common, and not everyone is going to react the same way.
You know, it's unfortunate, the things that stick in people's minds, because for some reason we can talk about the benefits of fruits and vegetables and et cetera, and yet people continue to eat what they want to eat. And yet when there's some little scandal or something, that sticks in people's minds. So there was a scare a while ago in the 90s, I think, about with alfalfa sprouts.
Yeah.
And how they were dangerous. Do you remember
Yes.
what that was about? And
Yeah.
should we worry?
Well, you know, there's a couple of scares. You know, there's the salmonella scare. But, you know, no food is immune to salmonella and E. coli.
I just want to stick in here that mostly all of this comes from animal agriculture, from confining animals in small spaces, in excrement and filth, and these things grow.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right, because it's possible to get, the dung from a rodent caught up in the combine when they're collecting the seeds from alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
So, the industry is now very careful about testing for that and about cleaning, and so we've reduced those incidences. But no food is immune. We've had it in the past year on spinach and tomatoes and melon and apple cider, and we don't hear about it as much on eggs and poultry and beef because those industries have such but first of all, it's old news, and they have such good PR and so when sprouts, which are a healthy food, come down with an outbreak on salmonella, it makes big news.
Yep.
Because it's supposed to be health food. How can health food be unhealthy? Well, unfortunately, no food is immune to pathogens. But there's never been a case of salmonella or E. coli with home growers, so you can rest assured. And I know on my brand of sprouting seeds, they're all organic, and they're all tested for salmonella and E. coli. And, you know, that's 99.9%. There's no 100% guarantee, but we test every batch. Nobody in the industry wants to be sending out pathogens.
You've got a new book coming out. We just have a couple of minutes left. What is that about? Why'd you write it? What can we look forward to in it?
The books we were talking about is not new. It's a new edition.
Okay.
It's called Sprouts, the Miracle Food. This book is a nutrition book. It's got the most nutritional information about sprouts in print. It's also a gardening book. So all of the steps about the gardening and all of the different sprouting devices that I recommend to use are in this book. As well as how to make your own sprouter at home, from, you know, making your own greenhouse, making your own kind of a colander or tray type of growing unit.
Mm.
And my other book on sprouting is called The Kitchen Garden Cookbook, and it's got the most recipes in print working with sprouts. And the third thing I want to tell your listeners about is Sproutman's Color Sprout chart, which is a turn-the-dial interactive kind of chart that hangs on your refrigerator, and it's a ready reference for, you know, how many days is this sprout going to take to mature, and how many tablespoons or cups do you use, and what's it going to taste like, and should it be grown vertically in a tray method, or should it be grown in a jumbled method like a jar or a sprout bag?
Okay, well, we have about a minute left, and can you just tell me why? I think sprouts are really, really tasty. Why do they taste so good?
We've got so many flavors really to choose from when you think about it. The sunflower and the broccoli. We've also can do chives like garlic chives. And China rose radish is absolutely spicy and delicious for people who like that. And Chinese cabbage and fenugreek a lot of things like garbanzo sprouts and sweet green peas and zuki beans, and it can actually get to be more extensive than the kinds of produce that we find in the produce market.
Right. Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that there's going to be a sprout month that's in June.
Yeah.
Is there a website or anything or any kind of PR that's happening about
it? Well, I'm probably the best resource for that. So
Sproutman.com.
Yeah.
Okay. And sprouts are great. They're nutritious. They're healthy. They've got a great crunch. They're crisp. And as you just were describing, there are so many different kinds with all kinds of wonderful flavors. And we can grow them ourselves. People that are concerned about the nuclear problem in Japan and radiation in food and produce, we can grow our own stuff in our home and feel pretty confident about its safety.
Yeah, it's time to stop treating our stomachs like a compost and start treating them like a garden.
Oh, I like that. Okay, let's get into the garden. Thank you so much, Sprout Man, for helping save the world from ourselves.
You're welcome. Stay healthy.
Okay, you too. That was Steve Meyerowitz. Go to SproutMan.com for more information. And I am Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for listening. Next week, we've got a great show. We're going to be talking to Dr. Esselstyn, Dr. Campbell, and Brian Wendell with their new documentary, Forks Over Knives. Thanks for listening.